So I'm Brian Bateman. Can you hear me? I probably need to lean over. I direct the McLaren Institute. Kirk mentioned that McLaren works to bring the Christian faith into dialogue with academic disciplines here at the University of Minnesota. And there'll be an opportunity a little bit later to sign up. If you're new, if you just heard about us for the first time and you're interested, you can sign up for our mailing list. And one of these people that sign up today will get an opportunity to win this book. So a little extra incentive. This is Professor Mylander's newest book. So it's a great pleasure for me to introduce to you Gilbert Mylander. He holds the Richard and Phyllis Duesenberg Chair in Theological Ethics at Valparaiso University. His PhD is from Princeton, and he taught briefly at the University of Virginia before having a quite long tenure teaching at Oberlin College. And in the mid-90s, he moved from Oberlin to Valparaiso, where he currently is. Professor Mylander is the author of numerous books, about 12 of them, and over 50 articles. Of particular interest to this audience, he has written a book called Bioethics, A Primer for Christians, and this came out with Erdmann's in 2004. He has written the book that I have before you here, Neither Beast Nor God, The Dignity of the Human Person. That came out last year from New Atlantis Books. And he is the co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of Theological Ethics, obviously from Oxford University Press. Professor Mylander writes regularly for First Things and Touchstone magazines. He is a fellow of the Hastings Center, a long-established, I think the first major bioethics think tank, a principal investigator for the new Science of Virtues project at the University of Chicago, and most notably served for 8 years on the President's Council for Bioethics from 2002 to 2009. Please, would you join me in welcoming Professor Gilbert Mylander.
Okay. You can, if you like, all the while I'm talking, you may continue to look up there, but nothing's going to change, okay? You may have gathered that from my rather makeshift arrangement here. A good old-fashioned lectern would have suited me just fine, actually. I know that those of you who are in medicine or the sciences are actually incapable of speaking without PowerPoint. I understand that. But with me, it's just words. That's all you're going to get. And I also thought I should say, it was their idea to give the book away to some lucky winner. That's not my idea. But as I sat here, I started to worry, really. I mean, the winner might get pummeled by a lot of other people. It's like the $200 Nikes, you know, that people beat you up to get. And so if you're the winner, you might want to kind of keep it to yourself and not broadcast it, just for the sake of your health. Well, the talk that I'm going to give you in this old-fashioned sort of way is really, as you'll see when I get started on it, the issue that I'm trying ultimately to get at is the question about payment for organs for transplant, whether it would be appropriate to do that. But as you're going to see, it's going to take me a very long time to get to that. For me, a considerable windup is required before we can understand why one might be reluctant to do that, which reluctance I'll be defending. But as I say, it's going to take me a very long time to get there. And if I tilt a little this way while I'm talking, they've got two of these mics on me, and they're both in this pocket now. So I hope I can stand straight. In many realms of life, there are questions that never actually go away. We address them more or less satisfactorily at one time. And so for a little while they may seem to go away, or at least they recede from the center of our attention. But because they're important and because probably they're puzzling also, they are likely to reappear. They sort of come back and demand new consideration. And in the realm of bioethics, one question of that sort that keeps coming back and has come back again recently is the question whether it could be right to try to increase the supply of organs for transplant by providing financial incentives for those who supply their organs, or even perhaps by establishing some kind of market in organs. These questions have received attention in the past, but in recent years, by which I mean the last 5 or 6 years or so, fueled by longer waiting lists for transplantation, the question has returned to the center of bioethical concern and has gotten a lot of attention. In May of 2006, the Institute of Medicine released a report that was titled Organ Donation Opportunities for Action. The report proposed certain fairly modest ways, methods of attempting to increase the supply of organs for transplant, but recommended against using any financial incentives in order to increase that that supply. And on May 15th of 2006, just very shortly after that report came out, responses to it appeared on the op-ed pages of both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Sally Satel in the Times and Richard Epstein in the Journal attacked the Institute of Medicine report for its timid, narrow-minded, and unimaginative thinking. The key lesson in all this, Epstein wrote, the key lesson is that we should look with deep suspicion on any blanket objection to market incentives, especially from high-minded moralists. That would be somebody like me, I see. Especially from high-minded moralists who have convinced themselves that their aesthetic sensibilities and instinctive revulsion should trump any humane efforts to save lives. Now, this is a serious challenge from a very smart economist, but I think it is in some respects also a challenge that is forgetful and misleading. It's forgetful because it has lost contact with some of the reasons that moved our society to turn to an organ procurement system based on giving, reasons that a good bit of my windup is going to be devoted to. And it's misleading because in its animus against what Epstein calls moralism, it adopts a rather too simple moral position for which the saving of lives always has moral trump. The questions that need asking are not aesthetic, they are anthropological. And it would be a shame if we were to become tone deaf to those questions, however difficult to articulate they may be. So, for instance, we have to ask ourselves, even if we simply assume that there is a shortage of organs for transplant and that it is imperative that we overcome that shortage, how would we decide whether a market in organs was an acceptable way to try to meet that imperative? How decide without first asking ourselves what organs and bodies are? Or how decide without asking ourselves who the person is who, with a kind of sovereign freedom, disposes, whether by gift or by sale, of bodily organs? After all, not everything is for sale, and we cannot decide whether a thing is a commodity that should properly be marketed without thinking about the kind of thing it is. I believe, though, that when this issue keeps coming back, that we're actually reluctant to think through those sorts of concerns because we have a sense, and an appropriate sense, that thinking it through may raise some disquieting questions about organ transplantation more generally. So we're sort of tempted to let the question slide and begin in the midst of things with just particular questions about payment that seem more manageable. To his credit, Richard Epstein sees this. In an earlier essay of his, he had noted some arguments that Leon Cass had offered against the sale of human organs, arguments that were based in considerable part on what Cass called the dignity of the embodied person. And then Epstein wrote this, and he put his finger on the point that I think lots of times we'd actually rather avoid. He wrote, "Taken at one level, Cass's arguments," which were arguments just against payment, financial incentives for organs, "taken at one level, Cass's arguments are so strong that they would preclude gifts as well as sales." Epstein says that, you know, really take the argument seriously, you would undercut the whole system of donation that we have in place. We have trained ourselves to think that organs are the sort of thing that can be given in the good cause of saving lives. But it now turns out that there are still more lives to be saved. Well, we need more organs. Why then exactly are organs not the sort of thing that can also be sold in this same good cause? If we've learned to think of the organ as a separable part that can be offered, given to someone else, if we no longer see this as a kind, as people once would, as a kind of problematic self-mutilation, then it's hard to know why sale of these separable parts should be forbidden. The organs procured will save more lives. They'll mitigate the shortage that operates as a kind of presumed problem in the argument. What more needs to be said? So perhaps we have to ask ourselves, go back to ask ourselves some of those basic questions. In what sense, what do we mean by saying that there's a shortage of organs that constitutes a crisis that must be overcome? On what basis, if any, should we suppose that the organs of one's body ought to be available for transplant into another person's body? Without making at least some headway in addressing those sorts of questions, I don't really know how to think about proposals for increasing the number of organs for transplant, and in particular proposals for doing that by establishing some sort of market. So I want to start at the beginning by thinking about what it means to think of death as a problem that it's somehow imperative for us to solve. If a man is dying of kidney failure, and if his life might be prolonged by a transplanted kidney, but none is available for him, those who are connected to him by bonds of love or loyalty may quite naturally and appropriately feel grief, frustration, and even outrage. We are heirs of a tradition of thought that teaches us to honor each person's life as unique and irreplaceable, and it's not surprising, especially that those who love such a person should care about that. Although the sympathy that any of us feels in a given case is probably to some degree proportioned by the closeness of our bond with the one who is dying, we're right to honor the grief, frustration, and outrage of those who experience the death of a loved one as uniquely powerful. These quite natural feelings, widely shared in our society, lead to the belief that it's imperative to make more organs available for transplant. However, the very same feelings of urgency and desperation also make it hard for us to think critically about the assumptions that drive the transplant system. Take a very different sort of example. Suppose that we would once again experience a shortage of gasoline in this country, which could happen tomorrow if certain events were to take place. But let's say that relative to the demand, the supply becomes much scarcer than we would like. In the face of such a shortage, or actually even now in the face of the possibility of such a shortage, we could take certain kinds of actions. We could permit drilling in heretofore protected lands. We could concentrate on developing certain kinds of alternative energy sources, such as nuclear power. We could also, rather different approach, learn to moderate our desires and our demands for gasoline, altering the way we live, the pattern of our lives. So there are ways that we might deal with a potential gasoline shortage, ways that might perhaps work, but that would, at least in the eyes of some, exact a rather high moral cost. Drilling for oil in unprotected lands, developing something like nuclear power. And there are ways to deal with a shortage that would teach us to modify our desires in such a way that we no longer thought in terms of a shortage any longer. But those would entail accepting considerable limits on how we live and changes in our pattern of life. And so upon reflection, it's possible, probably we would actually disagree among ourselves, but we might well decide that neither of those sorts of answers to a gasoline shortage is a wise direction to take. And, you know, one could argue that. But it would be a very frivolous person who continued to speak of a shortage without considering carefully both sorts of alternatives: exploring new sources of energy, or moderating our demands and expectations. Most of the time, though, when the subject is organ transplantation, we attend only to the search for ways to procure new organs. we look for what that IOM report called opportunities for action. If, however, we were to moderate the demands we make on medicine, we might be less pressured to think in terms of an organ shortage. Alongside our natural desperation at the impending death of one who cannot be replaced, alongside our natural tendency to see death as an evil that we must combat, we have to set another angle of vision about what it means to be human. Each of us is unique and irreplaceable. That is true. But each of us also shares in the limits of our finite condition. We are mortal. The receiving of an organ does not, as William F. May once put it, the receiving of an organ does not rescue the living from the need to die. It only defers the day when they will have to do their own dying. Tolstoy's Ivan Illich, in the famous short story, knew very well the relentless logic of the syllogism: if all men are mortal and if Caius is a man, then Caius is mortal. But that logic seemed absurd to him when he tried to slot his own name into the syllogism. And yet, of course, there's truth in that as well. There's truth in that angle of vision. On the one hand, we should not deny the existential anguish of those who face death. We should also not deny, on the other hand, the homely truth that each of our names will one day find its place in the syllogism. To refuse to acknowledge that second truth would turn medicine into nothing more than a crusade against death, plagued constantly by a shortage of cures for one or another deadly ailment. In other areas of medicine, we have been ready to brand that sort of approach as inadequate, and recognition of our mortality ought to elicit similar caution when speaking about a shortage of organs for transplant. As Hans Jonas argued in one of the really seminal articles in the early years of the bioethics movement in this country, progress in curing disease is not an unconditional or sacred commitment. The survival of society is not threatened when we do not conquer disease, however sad that may be for those of us who suffer. From one angle, as long as just one irreplaceable person dies whose life might have been prolonged through organ transplantation, there will always be an organ shortage. From another angle, that is just the truth of the human condition. If we turn organ procurement into a crusade, we make of death a problem to be solved rather than an event to be endured as best we can with whatever resources of mind and spirit are available to us. To be sure, when a particular person, Ivan, Gilbert, faces death, we confront a problem that calls for our attention and our attempts to cure. But that's not all we confront. We also face the human condition that calls for wisdom and care. Sometimes, at least, it's possible that we will undermine the needed wisdom and care if we think of a person's death as only or primarily a problem that it is imperative we solve. So, having begun with that sort of caution, I want to think now a little bit with you about what it means when we think about organs of the body as available for transplant. Free just a little of that sense of a crisis that it's imperative that we solve. Let's think about what it would mean, the kind of price we would be willing to pay to increase the supply of organs. It may be that the limited supply of organs in our society is due to thoughtlessness, selfishness, fear, or limited altruism. It may also be, however, that the limited supply is based on rather weighty, if hard to articulate, reasons that go rather deep and that financial incentives might not touch. If the problem is thoughtlessness, selfishness, fear, limited altruism, maybe financial incentives would touch them. But there may be something more at work here. And so I want to start with that disquieting possibility that Epstein raised that we prefer to pass by. Forget the issues that rise down the road and that have been talked a lot about in recent years about whether some kind of payment for organs would be acceptable. Start farther back with the widely shared assumption that it is morally acceptable, indeed praiseworthy, freely to give, not to sell, but to give an organ when that donation may be life-saving. In a 1930 encyclical letter, Casti Canubi, Pope Pius XI wrote this. He wrote, "Private individuals are not free to do," and this was, by the way, not, this is not a peculiarly Catholic view. It would have been held by a lot of people. "Private individuals are not free to destroy or mutilate their members or in any other way render themselves unfit for their natural functions, except when no other provision can be made for the good of the whole body." Now, how does one get from that statement to Pope John Paul II's words 65 years later in an encyclical letter called Evangelium Vitae, when he wrote, "There is an everyday heroism made up of gestures of sharing, big or small, which build up an authentic culture of life. A particularly praiseworthy example of such gestures is the donation of organs, with a view to offering a chance of life, of health, and even of life itself to the sick who sometimes have no other hope." There's considerable movement in that 65-year period. But John Paul II's words notwithstanding, "We would not ordinarily want a physician whose treatment harmed us in order to bring benefit to someone else. And ordinarily, in most cases, a surgeon would not think of operating on a person in order to help somebody else other than the person being operated on. For we know a person only in his or her embodied presence. It's in and through that body that the person is a living whole. For certain purposes, legitimate purposes, we may try to think more reductionistically. We may sort of reduce the embodied person simply to a collection of parts, thinking of the person, you might say, sort of from below as the sum total of those parts. But we do not know, interact with, or love anybody understood in that way. On the contrary, we know them from above as a unity that is more than just the sum of various parts. The very idea of organ transplantation upsets that natural way of thinking, upsets it in a way that is problematic and calls for justification. Understandably, therefore, we have been inclined first to turn to cadaver donation. It seems to raise fewer problems, to procuring organs for transplant from newly dead bodies. Even here, however, a certain kind of caution is in order. There is something uncanny about a corpse, for it is someone's mortal remains. And we would, I think, worry about a medical student or a mortician who felt no need to stifle within himself a deep reluctance and contrary impulse the first time or even the 100th time he was called upon to handle or cut a human corpse. Reverence for the dead body is not, we think, completely incompatible with using it for a good purpose, but surely there's a good deal that this reverence would simply not permit. It is one thing, not, we hope, incompatible with such reverence, that medical students should, with fear and trembling, learn needed skills through dissecting a corpse. Would we think it equally unproblematic if corpses were dissected in high school biology classes? We accept that some people, out of a deep desire to serve the well-being of those who come after them, may give their bodies for dissection and use by medical students. Would we think it equally unproblematic if they freely donated their bodies for the manufacture of soap? I doubt it. If we really freed ourselves of sort of all reservations and reverence for even the corpse, we could develop the kind of bio-emporia filled with neomorts that Willard Galen sort of somewhat playfully envisioned more than 35 years ago. Repositories of brain-dead but breathing, oxygenating, and respiring bodies available for all sorts of uses. Medical training, drug testing, experimentation, harvesting of tissues and organs, manufacturing of various sorts. That relatively few of us would want to turn in that direction indicates again that certain deep impulses must be overcome before we use even the dead body, even for very excellent purposes. And there are some uses that would probably not be acceptable to any of us, even were the body freely donated for such use. That the corpse from which an organ is taken for transplantation is someone's mortal remains and not just a collection of readily available organs is also indicated by how hard it is for us not to think that the presence of a transplanted organ, or at least of certain organs, somehow brings with it the presence of the person from whom the organ was taken. Just those sorts of psychological complexities are at the heart of one of Richard Selzer's short stories. Selzer, who was himself a, I think he's retired now, but was a surgeon at Yale. In the story, Whither, which is titled Whither Thou Goest, there's a biblical allusion there, actually, by the way. When a woman named Hannah Owen writes to Mr. Pope, seeking permission to listen for just an hour to the heart of her deceased husband, which heart now beats in the body of Mr. Pope, she does so, as she puts it, because of the predicament into which the miracle of modern science has placed me. She professes no interest at all in Mr. Pope himself, other than as the repository of this heart whose beating she once knew well and longs to hear again. Such is the mystery of the body and its parts, however, that a reader may wonder about all this when, after finally receiving permission to listen to the heart now beating in Mr. Pope, Hannah is nervous as a bride. For her, at any rate, the heart now beating in Mr. Pope's chest continues to carry the presence of her husband. Now, that's fiction, of course, but it may be profound humanistic wisdom as well, that the organ, the body, and the person for whom that body is the place of presence are not so easily separated in our psyches is well known. In their book, The Courage to Fail, A Social View of Organ Transplantation and Dialysis, which was first published back in 1974, Renee Fox and Judith Swayze noted that the gift of an organ may be unconsciously perceived by donor and recipient as an exchange through which something of the donor's self or personhood is transmitted along with his organ. And writing more than a decade later than that book, in their second book on the subject called Spare Parts, Fox and Swayze had not found any reason to change their mind. They wrote that many recipients of transplanted organs have apprehension about absorbing a donated part of another known or unknown individual into his or her body, person, and life, and that doing so evokes deeply buried animistic feelings people have about their bodily integrity. So we should not too quickly assume that transplantation of organs, even from a dead body, is entirely unproblematic. Those mortal remains retain the look of a person's life. It's not just a mechanism whose parts work together well or poorly, but it's the unity of that individual life. The mortal remains signify the history of that life in all its connections, especially with those to whom the person now dead was closely attached. It is not bad. Indeed, it is highly desirable that they should honor their shared history and mourn their loss by demonstrating their reverence for that embodied life. And such reverence is a different thing from parceling out the component parts of a corpse in order to achieve a desirable goal. In order to relieve suffering or save life, some of us may overcome those considerable reasons for reluctance to give organs for transplant after death, but it would be troubling if we experienced no reluctance that needed overcoming, if our thinking and our acting were governed solely by the sense of an organ shortage that needed to be solved. To quote William F. May once more, May once wrote, "There is a tinge of the inhuman in the humanitarianism of those who believe that the perception of social need easily overrides all other considerations." Now let's begin to move a little closer to the living donor. Still very far from questions of financial incentives. Having come this far, we should remind ourselves, as many of you know very well, that the language of procuring cadaver organs for transplant is in some respects sort of peculiar or misleading. This is not the sort of cadaver upon which medical students hone their skills. Cadaver donation generally means taking organs for transplant from bodies which, though brain dead, as we've called it, and sustained entirely by medical technology, do not look dead. Hearts still beat, blood still circulates, respiration continues. The very concept of brain death that makes this sort of liminal state possible has come under challenge in recent years, and it's a challenge that will eventually have to be faced, though I think it can be successfully faced. But it is striking, for example, that when organs are taken from a brain-dead but heart-beating body, the dead body is generally first anesthetized, lest its blood pressure should rise precipitously. So even the brain-dead body seems to manifest certain integrative functions. Now, my point here is not to argue that we should dispense with the notion of brain death. On the contrary, as I said, I think there's still a good bit to be said in favor of it. But I simply note that even if this body with its heart still beating is a corpse, is a dead body, we would not bury it until it had, died all the way. A formulation which, even if inexact, which doesn't quite meet the way we come to talk, indicates that it is not foolish to think of such a body as in a kind of liminal state that is still closely related to the condition of living bodies. What we are in danger of losing here is a humane death. Indeed, death itself becomes a kind of technicality, an obstacle to organ procurement, which obstacle must be surmounted in order to procure the body's parts and accomplish our worthy purposes. This is equally evident in recent attempts, motivated again by the desire to diminish an organ shortage, to plan the deaths of patients in such a way as to procure organs almost immediately after the cessation of heart and lung activity. A patient on life support is prepared for surgery, taken to the operating room, given drugs that will protect the viability of his organs after death, removed from life support, declared dead perhaps as quickly as 2 minutes after cardiac arrest, at which time his organs are removed for transplant. So in an age that has worried greatly about having death occur in the dehumanizing context of machines and technology, that was in fact one of the energizing forces that got the bioethics movement off the ground in this country, in an age that has worried about that, our desperate sense that it is imperative to procure organs has led to precisely that: the loss of a humane death and acceptance of what René Fox called a desolate, profanely high-tech death. Now, we have yet to consider the truly living donor, not someone in that sort of liminal state of the brain-dead but heart-beating cadaver, but a living person who accepts injury to his or her body in order to relieve the suffering or preserve the life of someone else, usually, though not always, someone to whom that person is closely attached by ties of kinship or affection. Transplantation in these circumstances raises important questions about the relation of organs, body, and person. We need not question the charitable motives of the donor, even what Pope John Paul II in that passage I read termed the heroism of such an act. Nonetheless, it involves intending one's own bodily harm in order to do good for another. As I noted earlier, it's the sort of thing that in most other circumstances a surgeon would not even consider doing. And in fact, near the dawn of the transplant age, some 4 decades or so ago, noting the way in which our as people were struggling to find the kind of moral justification that they thought would work, noting the way in which some of those justifications of transplantation tended to imagine the person as what he called a spiritual overlord too far above his physical life, Paul Ramsey suggested that in the face of that exaltation of freedom to use the body for whatever good purposes we wanted, physicians would have to, as Ramsey put it, remain the only Hebrews. That is to say, remain the only ones who still thought of the person as a kind of sacredness in the body, in the flesh. Well, what then, if anything, makes that kind of surgical procedure acceptable, even good, in the context of transplantation? One way to address the question would involve trying to overcome the close connection of organ, body, and person. That is, we could try to train ourselves. We have, in fact, to some extent, begun to do that, to train ourselves to think of the organ as entirely separable from the body, and the body as little more than just a useful conveyance for the person. The body is just your prosthesis, the real you as something else. And we have sometimes begun to think that way. So, for example, Sally Satel, in the piece that I mentioned, suggested that thinking of the body's parts as not for sale is just outdated thinking, that we need to learn to think differently. But partly because it's not so easy to train ourselves to think otherwise, and partly because the very difficulty of doing so suggests that there might be something problematic about the attempt, we have in fact turned in quite a different direction. We have turned not to the, at least in theory, however some people have begun to think, we've turned not to the idea of separable parts, just sort of parts of a collection, but we have turned to the idea of donation, as our way of trying to sort of come to terms with what we're doing. To think of the transplanted organ as a gift means that the connection to the giver, to the donor, still remains. It's not just an entirely separable part. The connection to the donor remains and is recognized in the process. Now, whatever psychological complications this may entail, and it does entail some, Richard Selzer's story that I mentioned suggests that, whatever problems of that sort that may entail, what it does positively is that it protects us against supposing that our bodies are simply collections of parts that can be alienated from ourselves in the way a thing or a commodity can be. No, it's something else that's going on, something much more complex. One who agrees to donate an organ gives himself or herself, not just a thing that is owned, but one's very person. And a gift, even a gift of something other than the body, forget organs for a moment, a gift carries with it the self's presence. And it carries with it the self's presence in a way that sale and purchase of a commodity does not. This accounts, in fact, for the very, giving and receiving gifts is a very complicated procedure, wholly apart from organ transplantation. And there's a very strange mixture of freedom and obligation that go into the giving and receiving of gifts, and in particular to the experience of receiving a gift. One who gives has no obligation to do so, just gives, and therefore acts with a certain kind of freedom and spontaneity. But that same freedom and spontaneity are not quite possible, or at least not possible in the same way for the person who receives the gift. To receive it is to undertake to incur an obligation to use the gift with gratitude. If I borrow an example from a man named Paul Kamenish here, if I buy from a retiring professor a rare edition of Kant's works, thinking that I always wanted to read the Critique of Pure Reason, and now I'll have my own copy of it. And if, having read just the preface to the critique, I realized that Kant is not for me, in fact, and a year later I give those works to a paper recycling drive, that edition of Kant's works, I have not failed in any obligation of gratitude. You may think what I did is unwise in various ways, but I failed in no obligation of gratitude. On the other hand, if having invested himself in those writings over the years, this professor now makes a gift of them to me, and I receive that gift, I'm constrained to receive and use the gift with gratitude because it still carries his presence in the way that a purchased commodity does not. It misses something, therefore, to say, as Robert Veach, a very well-known bioethicist, does. Veach says at one point that the donation model, the model to which we've turned, is built on the premise that one's body in some important sense belongs to oneself. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's why we've turned to the donation model. That kind of model of ownership will eventually sever the person from the body, turn the body into just a prosthesis that we use. And once that's been done, it will be a very short step to pretending, although the psychology of it is going to be a little trickier, that the donated organ, being utterly alienable, retains no connection of any sort to the one who's given it. We have been wise not to think of our bodies that way, and instead to turn to the concept of donation as a way of conceptualizing for ourselves what we're doing, what happens in this very strange circumstance of organ procurement and transplantation. To think otherwise would lose the human and the moral significance of the body as the place of personal presence. To be sure, I know thinking in terms of donation does have its own difficulties. We will never surmount them entirely. I mentioned the psychological complexities. There are others. It may seem to trade too heavily on the language of sacrifice sometimes. There's a kind of a burden that comes with that. That is true. But nevertheless, the language of gift or donation is, I think, the only way we have, while permitting transplantation to go forward in the face of the real complexities that I tried to outline, it's the only way we have to continue to honor the sense in which the person, the human person, is an embodied whole, and the sense in which a transplanted organ carries with it continued attachment to the one who gives not just an organ, but himself or herself. Unless we appreciate that, and unless we appreciate the deep-seated and legitimate reasons for hesitation about organ transplantation, we have to first think through the reasons for hesitation. Unless we do that, we're likely simply to plunge ahead as if the weightiest imperative under which we labor were simply finding a way to get more organs for transplant. And if then, in order to try to solve a perceived shortage of organs, we turn to a method of procurement that invites and encourages us to think of ourselves simply as spiritual overlords, free to use the body and its parts however we see fit in the service of good causes, even if we turn the parts of the body into commodities in doing that, we may save some lives, more lives in the process, but we will begin to lose the meaning of the distinctively human lives we want to save. Even a practice of donating organs can be abused, of course, but permitting organ procurement as we have only through the practice of donation allows us, even if just barely, to retain a sense of connection between the part and the whole, the person and the body, the giver and the gift. It allows us, that is, not to undermine the meaning of our humanity in our attempts to do good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Mylander. I'd like to invite for a first question or comment or reflection Dr. Timothy Pruitt. And this particular microphone is for the recording, so you will just have to project in your usual good form.
Thank you, Dr. Mylander. That was it brought me back to my college days when I was back in philosophy and sitting in class and wondering. You know, when I finished medical school and I took the Hippocratic Oath, or the variant of it that came through, one of the things which was said, well, that I said, was that I would abstain from mischief. You know, I would do the things which did not hurt another person. How I got ended up being a transplant surgeon is a very long and circuitous story. But basically, all of what you've said today is entirely in keeping with the tradition by which we have gotten to where we are. Much of what we do in transplantation is to deal with people who are sick and who don't want to die prematurely. And we agree fully, none of us are going to be made immortal by doing this, but the premature death of not being able to see your kid walk down the aisle, not be able to participate in a graduation, not participate in a variety of things, is something which sits at the crux of what we do. And the notion of taking an organ from one person and giving it to another is really not where we want to be. I keep telling our fellows that someday we're going to be out of work, and that's going to be a good thing. We will either figure out how to grow organs, God forbid, that's going to create all sorts of different issues, that we will learn things about cell manipulation so that we can turn back a disease status, and that will also create issues that we can give more lectures on. We can use animals and potentially do xenotransplants, which raises this whole series of other issues as well. But for today, the only way that we can really effectively treat people is by taking an organ from one person, albeit dead or alive, and moving it to another. And the question is, what's the scope of this problem? I'm going to get to the whole question of situational ethics. Just like you gave us your preamble, I'll give you where I'm going to go through as to what are the thresholds which make us move from one position to another. In the United States today, there are somewhere around 400,000 people on dialysis. We put 100,000 people on dialysis every year. If we didn't do this, all these people would die. Okay, they just would. There's a disease out there called end-stage renal disease, which will kill you if you don't have some sort of support. We know that and this was all done years ago by Alexis Carrel, who could show that he could move organs around and they would successfully work. We know that if we give a functioning kidney to a person whose kidneys don't work, it compared to somebody on dialysis, that they'll live longer, they'll live better, and actually that it's a lot cheaper for society to take care of these folks. So there's both a financial incentive as well as a lifestyle incentive to treat these folks. Now, in the United States, with our current system, with almost 500,000 people with end-stage renal disease, we have about 85,000 people waiting for a kidney transplant in the United States. And out of these 85,000, we have about 8,000 donors every year that come up to be from deceased donation. And out of these 8,000 donors, we do somewhere around 12,000 kidney transplants a year. Well, we're not even coming close to taking care of the problem of what we have in our society. Well, you can easily say some of these people shouldn't be cared for, some of them shouldn't be this, some of them shouldn't be that, dialysis is fine. That's all fine and good. When the IOM report was written, one of my good friends was the major author of that, Jim Childress. He wrote, we had a long discussion about whether, what does donation mean in this context of what the need is? If there was no need for these organs, one shouldn't even ask for them. So that the real question would be in terms of using the current model of what we use, which is a gifting system, how effective is that, and are there other model systems which should be used if there is a huge societal need? And this, again, is going to go back to the situational ethics approach. It is wrong to tell someone a lie. It's not so, a lot of people will deny that it's wrong to tell someone a lie if you have, you're hiding a Jewish person during the Second World War, and the Nazis come and say to you at the door, do you have someone in this house that we want to take? And the answer to that is no. And that's, in theory, many people debate whether or not that's true, but that in certain sets, one thing is right and the other thing is wrong. So we end up with this problem with us today, and I'm going to go back to the Hippocratic Oath, as to what do we do? We still, on our side of the fence, on the folks who are going to be using organs to give to another person, we truly do believe that we as a society have to have an exceedingly bright line from which we can work with and look all of you folks who are not on our side of the line in the eye and say that we're still doing good for society. And that bright line is the concept of death, is that we don't take organs from people who are not dead. And that's just, and one of the things that Professor Melander alluded to was where is that line? And it has changed a fair bit as technology has gotten in as to how do we define it and where do people sit. But nonetheless, irrespective of how we do it, and it was a problem that the Presidential Council on Bioethics dealt with as to the definition of death in the era of technology, as to where does it sit? Is it, when is dead dead? But we are firmly on the belief that for us to function within society, we have to be on the side that we don't take organs from people who are not dead. And that however that is defined by not just the transplant community, but by the community at large, whether it's the critical care community, the neurologic community, whether it's society at large, whether it is the concept of death is one which is basically a legal concept, that if you then take someone's life who does not meet that definition, then in fact you are committing something which is taking of a person's life, which is murder or manslaughter or some sort of variant. So we are very acknowledging of that particular fact and will forever stay on our side of the line. It is such a crucial component that goes forward with this. Because, in fact, we do have to, as we took the oath a long time ago, make that concept of a refrain from doing mischief. The mischief in doing live donations is even worse, and this is in a large part a component which a lot of folks are looking for in terms of the marketability. There are a lot more live people in our country than dead people, and that if we are going to address issues of the prospect of using, of meeting the need, the medical need, of people who have diseases, that we will probably not be able to meet that need through death, and so we'll have to go for the live side. Now, so my question will be, again, coming back, is there's two points. One is there a human crisis need of people who are ill which will change the modeling system in which we go forward? We live in a world of donation. We deal with it both on the live side and the deceased side. Does there come a point where the people who are alive, not so much overcome, but will impact the way that we approach the dead? And to the extent that yes, we honor, yes, we respect, we incentivize lots of giving in our society, lots of giving through tax benefits and a lot of other things. We think that we can get people to give more by doing certain things to encourage them to give more. Can you envision that, and can you discuss that at all? Thank you.
I didn't mean to talk, sorry.
I've thought about this a little bit.
That's Professor Meiland. Yeah.
Well, just a brief word. I think of myself as trying to help the transplant community. And what I mean by that is this. The community, up till now, I realize that it's changing to some degree, and you were, in a certain sense, asking me to comment on the change. But the community has been committed to a model of donation. And if you want to be committed to that model, you better think through why, what the actual reason for it was. Because it was an attempt to find a way to do something that seemed very problematic, but to do it in a way that is not dehumanizing. If we once set up the issue the way you do, I think the move toward providing financial incentives is inevitable, and it's just going to happen. If the issue is essentially there's a crisis, the way we've been doing it is not effective. So that what might have been okay in one situation is no longer quite the right answer in this situation. We need to look for some way that will be more effective in presumably getting the number of organs that we need. You're on your way to a market in organs. But if the position that the transplant community itself took in adopting a donation model was correct, and I was trying to argue it was, The other way to end that sentence is not to say you're on your way toward a market in organs, it's to say you're on your way toward something very dehumanizing. But to solve that, I think you need to set the problem up differently. It can't just be a matter of a crisis for which we're looking for an effective means. Sometimes there are good things we'd like to accomplish, but no acceptable means to do it. I think we have to set the problem up a little bit differently first if we're going to save the transplant community from itself. That's my view.
Let me ask one corollary to that. Some countries and some theorists have argued, let's just have presumed consent, which means if a person doesn't opt out, then they're in. Now, I know in the history of informed consent and the reading of documents or biobanks and these sorts of things, oftentimes that takes advantage of those that don't have the time or care to read carefully the forms. But the argument for presumed consent is, well, we take out sort of the explicit financial motive and we just say we're in a community and we have a communitarian ethic of presumed helping or altruism. And so we remove the exchange of dollars, but we also, in a sense, remove the choosing of the person if the person is not attentive to the structure. I would think that would have some of the same difficulties that you would find even though money isn't being exchanged for that particularly.
Well, I'm not a fan of presumed consent, though not primarily because it simply takes away the choosing. I mean, we need to talk about what you mean by a communitarian ethic, in what sense the person simply belongs without remainder to the larger community, and it has a claim on him. And I think it puts places a burden. If what I had to say in the talk was right, and I of course think it is, but I've been around long enough to know that not everybody is likely to agree. But it puts a burden on the loved ones just at the time when they are trying to grieve the loss of this person. They may have to fight. To sort of claim the person at the very time they're trying to let them go. I think it's just it places a certain kind of psychological burden that we ought not place. So for several reasons, I'm not a big fan of it.
I'm Susan Gunderson. I'm the chief executive with LifeSource, or the Organ Donation Agency. There's much to say, but I would just like to clarify one point. You'd referenced and characterized the donation as a sacrifice or a burden. And I would challenge that. We have the opportunity and the privilege to come into families' lives at a time of loss, at the time of death. Death is assured. And donation is not a sacrifice or a burden. It is an opportunity to create a legacy for the individual who has lost their life. And for someone to have made that decision in life and to have those gifts carried out after life is really something that we hear consistently does not take the pain of the loss, but it creates a story and a legacy that goes on that you did characterize in the short story that you referenced. So I think the paradigm is a little bit different, that this is a gift and there is a great deal of good that comes out of the donation. Thank you.
I didn't deny that it was a gift, but systems of giving and receiving gifts can be burdensome on some occasions. If we had more time, I would want to explore the legacy language quite a bit there, in what sense that is or is not a legacy. But I understand that in your work you have a certain way of conceptualizing what you're doing. That doesn't mean that it captures entirely the human realities of what's going on.
Thank you. Barb, could you hand out the evaluation forms? If you have time to fill them out, we'll have to take two more questions.
I have course evaluations all
yes,
the time.
Even here. I'm trying to remember when the next event starts. I think we have till half past to get out, but why don't we take two more questions, and then we can discuss a little bit informally here after. Thank you. Please, it's good to see you.
At first, a comment and then a question. The comment is regarding crisis. For a patient on dialysis who is suffering and feeling their life dwindling, each day is a crisis. The question has to do with how we value the earning aspect in our society. So we send miners choose to become miners and earn their salary, risk their lives for us so that we heat our homes. Young men choose to earn their livelihood by becoming soldiers and dying for us. People may choose to earn by helping another, and for them, finding that a very positive thing. So it's not an either-or, commodity or gift. It may be both, and insofar as it is both, it is legitimate, as is mining and serving your country in war.
We have time for me to respond?
Yeah.
On the first point, I did not deny, indeed, I thought I hammered home the fact that for the person on dialysis, it's a crisis, okay? I simply said that the fact that that's true for each individual person does not in itself settle the larger social questions of how we ought to approach these things. What I said was, as long as there's just one person who could be saved through an organ, a transplanted organ, and doesn't have it, you can call it a crisis if you want. So the issue is not numbers in that way. But on the other matter about financial incentives, most of us work in various ways to earn money. It may or may not be what Marx called alienated labor, but that doesn't mean that there might not be ways of using the body to earn money that are essentially misuses of it, that turn the body into something other than the place of the presence of the person. We could think of some other examples of ways in which one might use the body in order to earn money that we would not necessarily think were right. And so the simple fact that there are miners and soldiers doesn't in itself demonstrate that this too is an acceptable use of the body as a way of earning money, I don't think.
From one of the area schools here. Is there somebody here who is in the school that would like to... that would like to ask a question, any of the students here that aren't university students? And if not, is there anybody else that would like to ask one final question? And... Oh, okay. Well, there's one up here. And...
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know if this really has any bearing on the moral questions involved in these issues, but I have a very strong impression that in most of most of this country, one of the side effects of our scientific illiteracy is that people have really flowery misconceptions about what is involved in organ transplant. They think it is just like, well, all your internal organs are just replaceable parts. I'll just go in and get another one when it wears out. They don't understand that the surgical procedures are very risky. These are challenging risk benefit assessments that are done. You have immediate issues with rejection and then with graft versus host disease, and the person, they extend their life and hopefully they maintain some quality of life if things don't go drastically wrong, but there's a significant difference in the quality of life that a person has subsequent to these sorts of procedures. And I think there's some impact to this misconception that is very broad in our society. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, you may well be right in some cases. I mean, I assume that transplant surgeons and other members of the transplant team have worked very hard to try to make sure that the people involved, that their consent to this is really informed, that they really know what they're doing. Now, it is true that the greater our desperation, the less likely we may be to hear everything and only hear what we want to hear. So I don't doubt that there are misconceptions abroad. Those, however, I think are probably, I mean, those are not the fault or the responsibility of the folks doing the transplant. I think they're working pretty hard to try to get this across. It's got to do more with our unwillingness to face the fact of certain limits in life, you see. And medicine has become a kind of savior in a lot of cases, and that's what we look for there. So we need to train ourselves to think a little differently, I believe, if that's not to happen.
One person just asked me about the film Never Let Me Go. Have you seen that?
No, I read the book. Yes. Mm-hmm. No, it's very powerful. The book's powerful.
Have you written a film book review?
No, I've not. Sorry.
Sorry. All right. Well, thank you very much for your attention. Leave evaluations at the exit as you go, and I very much appreciate this. Again, we'll have this the recording posted on the Program in Human Rights and Health website, and we again thank Dr. Mailander for his.